T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Good evening and welcome to Amplify, a telephone talk show that looks at life from a religious perspective. I'm Father Ron Langwin, hoping that you have felt the warmth of God's love in your life this day, but especially the joy you feel when you share God's love with others. As we do each week, I'd like to begin our program with a story that is based on faith and formed with imagination, one of the more than 1,000 stories we've told over the decades. Men who were considered to be wise often came to visit Jesus when they heard about his great knowledge. "Welcome," Jesus said to a man who had made such a journey from his hometown. "I've heard about your love for others." The man was surprised by Jesus' remark, but quickly replied, "And I have heard about how much you do for others, Master." Having traded compliments, they smiled at one another. Jesus said, "Come, sit with me." The man was pleased and said, "I'll share my fruit with you." Jesus responded, "And I shall share my bread with you. But I know you have not come just to eat with me. You have come seeking knowledge, and I am pleased to give it to you." The man nodded and said, "You are wise indeed." Then he just looked at Jesus, and it seemed like an eternity before he finally spoke again and asked, "Master, is man divided in two?" Jesus didn't answer immediately, and so the man asked again, "Master, is there not a physical side to man and a spiritual side? Does not the spiritual side draw life from the heart of the Father?" "Yes," Jesus answered. "And does not the spiritual side tell the physical side what to do?" "No." "No," Jesus answered. "They must work together. Man does not always do what his heart wants him to do, to comfort the sick or to share one's bread. The physical and spiritual must work together as one, like a fish is to water, air to a cloud, a seed to the earth, fruit to a tree, and a mother to her child." The wise man looked at the bread Jesus had shared with him and said, "The bread you have given me has more meaning than the eye can see, doesn't it?" "Yes," Jesus answered. "Not only is it the staff of life, it is also the bond which unites the heavens and the earth." The old man said, "You are wise, far beyond your years. It has taken me so long to learn what you have learned in such a short time." Jesus sighed and said, My friend, man must work to attain a perfect union between his body, mind, heart, and soul. Such a union will give man the strength and gentle caring which my Father's love possesses." The man smiled and started to give the remaining bread back to Jesus, who said, "No, my friend, take it, for you have a long journey ahead of you. When you eat it, think of me. And when I return home, I shall tell my Father, there are still many mysteries in the world which man has not solved, but that some men use their entire being, body, mind, heart, and soul to do his will." A story of faith and imagination. Our guest this evening writes in the preface to his book titled The Winding Road of Transformation, Finding Yourself Between Glory and Humility. And I dodge around a little bit here, but he begins. "This book is about transformation, about doing deep heart work. It's about discovering interior freedom and seeing God's masterful work, hand at work. And it is about glory and humility and the beautiful way they interact to drive us toward our true selves. Even when the way appears crooked and bent, even when the path turns unexpectedly, especially when it does. But transformation isn't merely the subject matter being discussed. The truths of this work are woven into the fabric of the writing itself. The writing process was much more discovery than deduction. It emerged rather than having been constructed. And the ideas that I share are both truthful and as raw as I could be. Because life is a winding road, unpredictable, confusing, and without a clear course or map. And this winding seems to be intentional. It's there by design. It ensures that we remain close and pay attention to our guide and learn to trust his words even when times are cold and dark or when the voice has become quiet or even absent. When we start to lose our vision and begin to long for that comforts of home. And the winding path ensures that our eyes become trained to see and recognize the provision and goodness that otherwise go overlooked in our hurry to get from one place to the next. Because these glimpses of joy along the path sustain us. They renew us. And they remind us that there is more to come. Our guest is Jeffrey Tacklin. He's lead pastor of Church of the Sea in Lagana Beach, California, where he lives with his wife and three children. He is a spiritual director and has a master's degree in philosophy and a doctorate in semiotics and future studies. Jeffrey Tacklin, welcome to Amplify.
Hi, thank you for having me. This is so fun.
Well, I hope it's going to be. Let's get away from the book just for a second. A doctorate in semiotics and future studies. Just tell me a little bit about that. I went to the internet to find out about signs, and you know, I learned that the study of signs is the study of the construction and maintenance of reality, and to decline such a study is to leave to others the control of the world of meanings which we inhabit. But I'm just looking for a minute, just a little bit, because it says at the beginning of this article, they may not be able to really tell you what it is, so just walk away. So
that's great. Well, semiotics, yeah. Well, I mean, you're right. It has to do, it's an aspect of philosophy, an area of philosophy that deals predominantly with signs and symbols. And it's a degree that I took part in under Leonard Sweet. I'm not sure if you know that name, but he was our doctoral mentor. And it's really a way that he stressed in the end of reading scripture through this lens of interpreting the signs and the symbols. And when you see scripture in that way, you realize that there's all these kind of common threads that you can follow, whether you're taking an image like bread or you're taking an image like water, an image even like blood, and to follow that line through, really in so many ways, the story is told more poignantly through the symbols. And then the power of them is that it's not just a bite of text, but it's something that we sit with and continues to kind of unveil itself over time. So it's a really fun way of seeing and interpreting. But as it turns out, I think advertisers and so many have grasped onto this idea that the power is in the symbols. And so it's a way of seeing life, seeing the beauty through that lens.
And controlling the world of meaning is certainly very important, especially if it comes to the Bible. That has influenced, I think, the way you wrote this book, isn't it? Probably influences just about everything you do. But after I read about what it was, I thought, words are very important and have a great deal of meaning. And that comes out when you speak about your life and speak about your wife.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's really true. And, you know, I live in a community in Laguna Beach. It's very much like a sort of artist colony in its roots and its history. And so a number of people in my church are artists by profession. And I realize that they kind of naturally think this way. It's a sort of way of seeing the world. But that idea of seeing something not just on the surface, but then seeing its depth and what lies beyond it, and kind of the freedom to let everybody just sort of grasp onto it where they are and where they're coming from.
Yes.
It's kind of a gift that the signs and the symbols give us.
You express that well in your book when you say it's an eclectic and eccentric, diverse and charming faith community. It also is quirky, difficult, reactive, and dysfunctional. And you end by saying that we have people who regularly speak in tongues and others who believe such spiritual displays are a bunch of nonsense. And so we hang in there like families do. We continue together to hold. To me, that alone is evidence of God's grace. Said so well. Let's get into the book, Glory and Humility. Tell us a little bit about the two longings that you once believed had created a tension in the deepest places of your heart since you were a child, glory and humility.
Well, yeah, I think that I saw those two as, in a way, kind of opposed to one another. And I grew up with that, like, deep down longing to do something noble and meaningful, and yet understood, too, how my ego would so easily get involved and take over and want to tell these sort of grandiose things for my own gain. And so there was this virtue of humility, of staying meek and you know, not insisting on the spotlight. And so I think what I ended up trying to do so often is just find a balance between the two. It was like a little bit of nobility with a dose of humility, and seeing that kind of as a trade-off, when in fact realizing that those are instead two trajectories God is pulling me towards fully. The idea of glory is something that God doesn't want us to think less of, but even more of. I think God's idea of glory for us is much larger oftentimes than we would see for ourselves. And yet the humility to go along with it becomes a necessary way of being able to hold it without clutching it or taking it and twisting it to my own gain. And so the humility or the selflessness, the idea of dying to self, it becomes not something that runs counter to that glory, but instead it kind of parallels it and pulls us towards something greater.
Yeah, towards transformation, you point out.
Yeah.
And that the tension it creates can be exhausting, confusing, and misleading. You have an interesting relationship with God. We all do, if we're really attentive to it. I don't know whether adjective to use, but it interesting sort of stands in for just about anything that can happen. But you pointed out that God wants you to have more of both and won't settle for less when it comes to glory and humility. And that God sometimes, you believe, wants more of you than you want to give. Why is that?
Well, I think, you know, part of that is just my personality. It craves comfort, probably. You know, I long to do something meaningful, but maybe a stronger impulse in me, or at least, one that will often get in the way is kind of a desire to, well, as I've said in the book, I think, kind of fly below the radar. There's a safety in that oftentimes will win out. And so I feel when I sense God's guidance, it's often nudging me forward where I'm lacking the courage or maybe just don't want to go simply because I like the comfort of home. I love the safety of, you know, what I can control and how God is often prodding me out the door to take that kind of greater path. And so as I watch in my relationship with God, I see time and again, oh, I recognize what you're doing here, which is asking me to be more courageous. But every time I think I trust it, but at the same time, there's resistance in me too.
Hey, you're a peacemaker, but also a questioner. You sometimes want to stop asking questions, and yet it gives rise to the question, are you with me or against me? And when God spoke to you in your relationship with God, he told you, you believe, to find a symbol in nature that spoke to you of your current spiritual life. And we're talking about a year ago, and the book develops in another little direction. But why did you select a smooth stone from a creek bed?
Well, I think it was, to me, a symbol that I picked that in my own mind because it was easy. I think it made sense. I looked at my life at that point, and I was exhausted. I was sort of tired and worn down, and I think as any pastor, I can take and sort of spiritualize that and come up with an idea of what would represent that. And so that was kind of the assignment, go find a sign or symbol in this creek bed. And I just thought, oh, that's easy. I'm just going to grab a rock, and that will adequately explain the state of my heart, when in fact I think God had a different symbol in mind.
Right, and in his search, he did have a different symbol in mind. It was a white elder, unimpressive tree. You didn't like the comparison at first, did you?
No, I think it sort of, I was maybe a little offended or disappointed at the symbol to begin with, in the sense that there was nothing impressive about it. But not only that, it lived in this kind of dry middle place, this creek bed that I was in. And I realized that the underlying emotion that I was experiencing at the time was what I think a lot of leaders feel, which was a deep loneliness. And so to see this tree standing alone in this in-between place, I was a little bit overwhelmed, because I wanted to see my current condition as temporary, that it was a sort of passing phase that I was in, instead of looking at this tree and realizing it can only live in this middle place, only live in this stream bed, and realizing that what God was speaking to me wasn't descriptive of my period of life, but something instead about who I was. And so, at first it was a little hard to hear.
That middle place you point out is dangerous. Always being in the middle is dangerous, and you're often in that position in your church. Why is it dangerous?
Well, you know, I offer a little Dallas Willard quote in there where he's talking about the Beatitudes, and he has a different take on it. He's going to say with each one of those, blessed even are the poor in God's kingdom, poor in spirit, blessed even are those who suffer. And when he comes to peacemaker, he says, blessed even are the peacemakers, and because they're going to be called sons of God, and then goes on to say, because they're so rarely considered that, they're standing in that place, kind of in between two sides, neither side, well, both sides realizing that that person in the middle is not on their side. And so you get stuck in this place where you don't have a team. You're arbitrating, but between two people that look at you with an element of suspicion. And at least that's what it can feel like. That's what the tension can feel like sometimes. So the peacemaker stands in many ways alone and not completely trusted. And that really rang true for me as I was standing there. But not just for that season of life, but I think I've always found myself sort of in the midst, as I see opposing viewpoints and arguments, and find myself in this place where I'm hearing the truth in both, and not completely satisfied with either position, or seeing what's being missed. And so I've always sort of had an ear for that, or an eye for that.
Hold that thought, because we need to take our break, that you've always had an eye for that and an ear for that. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion. Welcome back to Amplify, where our guest is Jeffrey Tacklin. He's the lead pastor of Church by the Sea in Laguna Beach, California, where he lives with his wife and three children. He loves the Lord of the Rings, and he writes, when he was a child, he says, I was moved by emotions that were familiar, and yet being awakened for the first time, a longing for depth and nobility, for a life of glorious deeds done without need of recognition, and for depth of character that refused to turn back or look away in despair when hope was seemingly lost. As I would read, I would find myself desiring to be the very best version of myself, because I see in the characters not only characteristics I long to possess, but a quality of life that feels big enough to contain my heart. Something about the mythical and heroic speaks to our truest callings in life, and that calling is glory, not fame, not success, but glory. And as we ended the first part of our program, we were talking about the middle place in life and how important it is. It's a dangerous place to be in, but he writes about he's always been a reluctant leader when leadership is his calling. True calling shows who we are becoming, that we all are already in God's eyes, and that we can't live without love, and we don't ever arrive in this lifetime. But Jeff, as we stopped, you were finishing some thoughts about the middle place in life. Okay, did you lose them?
Yeah. Oh, can you hear me?
Yes. No, okay. I meant, did you lose the thought?
Did I lose my thought? Oh, gotcha.
I'm sorry.
No problem. No. I think that it's an interesting thing. As I was working with editors on this book, you know, one of the questions somebody asked me was, Jeff, this idea of peacemakers, is this just your story? Is it all of our story? And which is a good question. And I think it's probably both of those things. I mentioned in there that my name means peacemaker, which
right,
my parents
yes.
always kind of thought they had misnamed me because I had this tendency to sort of pry at things or ask why or want to know the reason behind the reason. And so that seemed like I was leading to anything but peace, you know. But I think I always, when I would listen and hear, you know, two sides to an issue, I had this tendency to see the heart of what was behind it, and to realize that so often in our disagreements it's just two people talking past each other, that that we're not listening, that we're not hearing each other. And so for me, I think because of that, I just sort of naturally found myself in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm realizing, especially getting feedback from the book, I think so many of us find ourselves there, or we find ourselves in a world that is so polarized and so at odds, and we find ourselves torn between whether it's people that we love or positions that we find neither completely satisfying or compelling. We find ourselves occupying this space of a peacemaker. So some of that's my wiring, but I think some of that's kind of in all of us.
And it's a theme that continues throughout the book. And through divine providence, God speaks to us often through others. And someone said to you when the whole discussion was taking place about who should become the lead pastor, said, deep roots are not reached by the frost. And that became a very important concept in your life, didn't it?
Yeah, it really did. For a number of reasons. I mean, it's a line from a poem that's in The Lord of the Rings that is beautiful. The first line is, all that is gold is not glitter. Not all who wander are lost. The old mm-hmm. that is strong does not wither. Deep roots are not reached by the frost. And it's a wonderful poem about this central character, Aragorn, who is this reluctant leader. And I think I always have sort of admired his strength. That was part of his strength is his humility. That somehow his reluctance, that almost protected him. You've got everything in those books is about this pursuit of power, and yet here you have somebody who is sort of the promised king that doesn't want it, and you get this feeling that humility is almost a shield protecting his heart. You know, there's a phrase, you know, the first qualification to become a bishop is to say, I don't want to be a bishop. It's
yes.
There's a sort of way that protects us from ourselves and our pride and our ego that gets in there. So, you know, to have those words spoken to me, I think it just resonated on so many levels of who I would long to be, who I want to be, and also maybe where I see myself falling short and need to have the courage to step more fully into what God's calling.
Yeah, you really open yourself up to us through your book. You speak of yourself as a self-designated wallflower, and that intimacy doesn't come easy, and you didn't think you could succeed as the leader of the church, but you will acknowledge that God knows us intimately, that God's kingdom works on a completely different value system than ours. And you've had a couple experiences there. One was a friend, God told you to place your hand on his shoulder, and you felt a little strange about doing that, but you felt a great surge of energy, as did your friend. And so yeah. we need to be alert to things like that that are happening in our lives.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if I looking at myself and how I'm wired, if I was to find a flaw in God's design, I would say, you know, he, as an introvert, I haven't been given the same emotional capacities that some of my other friends have to just go all day, social all the way through, whereas I find myself with limited windows, and like by the end of the night, I kind of jokingly say I'd like Cinderella and the coach is going to turn back into a pumpkin. And I've always thought, God, I think I could have been more effective had you just given me a little bit more there. And that idea of God using, in fact, our weaknesses, I think that's part of the winding path, is this idea that what at first glance seems like a flaw in the design is there brilliantly placed by God, that weakness becomes an opportunity then for me to have to experience a whole nother level of dependence on God. And when I see God respond in my weaknesses with his strength, gosh, the two just don't compare. And gosh, that opportunity there to extend not Jeff's love, but God's love, to feel him meet those needs instead of my own small resources, is powerful in just understanding purpose and why I'm here.
And to amplify on that, you write, God in his brilliance guides us into that place of vulnerability and ultimately freedom. He pushes us into our calling and attacks the pride that holds us back. It is a noticeable pattern that shows itself in almost every story told in Scripture. God presents a vision and then asks for it back. God promises freedom and then leads his people into the wilderness. In all of this, God prepares the hearts of his people for a vision greater than they can comprehend. And then you write about how God asks us to do the easy part, and then he does the rest. And God wants each of us to be the person he has created us to be, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. But I think sometimes that person that we are created to be, in many ways, exceeds any sort of goal that we would set. God's ceiling is so often much higher. And, you know, one of the verses that I quote in the book and has just been so important to me is when God is speaking to Jeremiah and saying, you know, if you stumble running against men, how are you going to race against the horses? And that idea of horses, you know, I just hear Jeremiah going, who said anything about horses? And yet God is going, oh, this is who you are. This is how fast you are. And so there's that surge of God's belief that comes, but it requires faith, and it requires some humility to be able to just lean on God for that work. He's going to have to do a deeper transformative work for us to be able to reach that point.
And sometimes it means leaning on Patty, doesn't it? His wife.
It sure does.
he despaired at one point for a few days when he felt threatened by his wife's growth, but she doesn't enter into this story a whole lot, but boy, she enters in at the very perfect moment when Jeff needs to understand something that perhaps he's misunderstanding, or at least it's given him fuller understanding. Say something about Patty in your life, lest we forget it before the program ends.
Yeah, well, what would I do without her? That story, well, let me just first say that chapter was the hardest to write about her. And at a time where I knew deep in my heart I should be celebrating her because she was growing and growing in vision and reconnection with talents that she's had possessed that were kind of latent and coming to life. And here was this surge of my wife just getting bigger. And wow, I found myself at first was delighted, and then was slowly becoming threatened by it, realizing that I was going to have to keep up. And And again, that's where that sort of comfort and self-protection comes in, because there's a part of me that thinks this was working. And to find myself dealing with emotions like jealousy and insecurity, her growth was pulling out things in myself that I would have rather not seen. And yet, I needed so badly. And I think, again, that's part of how God has just so brilliantly worked in the midst of all this, was placing her in my life just who I needed, that she draws me through my desire and my relationship with her to become more truly who I am. But some of that happens when we're out of sync. Some of that happens when her growth holds up a mirror to myself and lets me see my weakness.
Right. The one person you write you need becomes your greatest threat. There can be no compromise. Any movement feels threatening, because when one spouse grows, so must the other. Either both of you grow or both of you stay small. Either our love is generative or it is degenerative. And in my case, growing almost always involves increased generosity. It asks for more of my precious time, more of my heart, to surrender my ego, to love Patty like I love myself. So, you write about desolation, and you indicate that we have the opportunity for increased self-awareness, because sometimes we avoid the very thing we need. How can desolation be a positive?
Well, I often, think of desolate times as desert times. They're wilderness times. They're times that often involve large amounts of inner reflection. And those times of desolation, I think for me, often are times where I find I have to go into more of a solitary place, more of a contemplative space. That the desolation forces us to slow down. It forces us to pay attention and to listen. And so often in life, we're moving at a frenetic pace. We're moving from thing to thing in this way of constant distraction. And I think desolation or desert pulls us, slows us down to a time where we're listening for that still small voice. I think oftentimes those desolate moments can become times of real intimacy in our relationship with God. I think that you see that even mentioned throughout the scriptures, that there's treasures that we discover in the darkness, that there's new ways of seeing God that happen only in those kind of wilderness spaces. So the desolation as well is a gift, but it also has a suffering sort of component in it that is refining our hearts. And the suffering, too, in the end is a gift, but it's costly. And so desolation is probably something that I would never just go seeking after myself, and yet looking back are some of the times that I feel like I've experienced God's presence so powerfully.
You write about the illumination of waiting and point out that so much of life involves waiting. If we think about that, that's every day of our life in some form, but it becomes much deeper at other times. We live with expectation, you write, and there has been no bad news, but there is no news. It has been called many things, including disconnection and that lonely feeling. How do you believe God is showing us love when he makes us wait?
Well, I think, again, a lot of this points to the sort of transformative work that God does. There's that beautiful prayer by Teilhard de Chardin, who says, I think it's called Patient Trust, and he says, above all, trust the slow work of God. And I think that that just is the case, that the deeper work of God necessarily takes time. And so waiting and transformation and the slow work, I think, are so intertwined that, when God says, Paul's going to write in 1 Corinthians 13, when he describes what love is, he says it's two things, it's patient and it's kind. And I think both of those are often fostered through suffering and waiting, and so it's patience especially. And so that work of enlarging our hearts is connected to endurance, it's connected to our ability to persevere, and so waiting becomes in many ways the perfect classroom for us to grow in our ability to be generous and to love others.
What has been the influence of modern technology on waiting? You indicate that it makes waiting more intense in frustration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember years ago reading, I think Bill Gates said something like, when we have 8 megabytes of RAM, that, you know, when computers have that level of technology, we're going to basically be taking months at a time off of work because computers are going to just get everything done for us so quickly. And, you know, what I think is hilarious about that is that that's exactly not the case, that everything has only sped up. The faster, we're way beyond 8 megabytes, and we're like talking gigabytes of RAM now, and yet we seem to have less time than we ever did. And, you know, I think it just goes to show you this sort of human condition that we're in, where we will choose distraction, we'll choose this rapid pace at the detriment to our own health, almost as a way of trying to, well, I mean, in some ways it's to numb ourselves or, you know, divert our attention away from some of the deeper things that are going on. And so not only do we have less and less tolerance for waiting, but now we have a constant distraction. There is no wait. When you find yourself waiting for anything, your phone is immediately out and you're working the whole time. And I think because of that, because of this constant diverting distraction in front of us, the more subtle things get missed, more and more. We have less ability to see the beauty around us, the way that God is speaking, the way that God is leading. I think oftentimes our phones become the greatest detriment to hearing right. And seeing God.
Yeah, speak about the human condition, and to that last point, you write that the waiting can be like an unwanted mirror for my thoughts. There are places in my heart I'd rather not see. It's not just that we don't want other people to see them. I don't want to see them myself, do I?
Yeah. No, that's right. That's right. I think about, you know, there's a place I write about in there, this monastery that I'll go to just for times of quiet. And, you know, the first day, I think, is trying to get my brain to slow down in my prayers.
Yes.
They're constantly interrupted by thoughts or constantly interrupted by places that I would rather go. And it's almost a sort of detoxifying from the hurry and from the pace of life. So, but again, it's some of that is by choice. Some of that's rote, but some of that is by choice, because just to see kind of the underbelly, what's going on in my mind, can be discouraging.
Yes.
And so it's easier to just turn my attention away from what's going on in my heart and mind.
Right. St. Andrew's Abbey, I think, is a place you were referring to.
Yeah.
And when again, there's a quote here about Patty, that she seems to be able to quickly bring you back to reality, that marriage teaches us to love, but only God's love can truly blanket us with the grace that will set us free. And let me read us out then to our next break. You write, I like who I am and even enjoy feeling unique and different. And yet, deep down, I worry about what others think of me, much more than I care to admit. I'm afraid that maybe I'm the reason that everyone is laughing, that I'm the joke and everyone is just too polite to let me in. Why God guides us into these moments of helplessness, and this is where faith comes in, to lay our hearts before God, to stop hiding him and clothing ourselves with leaves. Welcome back to Amplify, second hour of Amplify, where our guest this evening is Pastor Jeffrey Tackland. He is the lead pastor of the Church by the Sea in Laguna Beach, California, where he lives with his wife, Patty, and their three children. We've been talking in the book. It's very gives deep spiritual insight into our lives and also some direction through its honesty and finding our place with God, who sometimes might seem to be too demanding, but that is not the case at all. We were talking about the last part. We were talking about a little bit about the struggles that we have, the ways in which we are have to deal with waiting. That so much in life involves waiting. And just to bring us to a conclusion on that particular chapter, he writes in his book, it's titled The Winding Path of Transformation. In The Sickness Unto Death, Kierkegaard says, quote, "With every increase in the degree of consciousness and in proportion to that increase, the intensity of despair increases. The more consciousness, the more intense the despair," close quote. And then he adds, "The only way forward is to enter into the painful silence with courage and vulnerability, to listen, to release, to accept, to allow ourselves to be seen by God and by others for who we really are, broken, helpless, and needy." Amplify on that just a little bit for us.
Well, I think in many ways those things are represent all the things that we're running from or hiding from, that our value is so often tied to the very opposite, that we have got it all together, that we are the ones that that never fall apart, that vulnerability, I know for myself and for so many, it feels weak, and we're doing everything we can to mask it, when in fact, that's right where God is trying to take us. I think that this idea of the pursuit of the true self, the one that God is seeking to transform, requires me moving towards that place of vulnerability, and not just once. It's not one mountain that we climb, but something that we are continuing to climb throughout our life. And so that idea, you know, that God is easily pleased and not easily satisfied, I think is kind of an underlying theme to all of that, that God celebrates the transformation as it occurs, but is constantly beckoning us further in and further in. And generally speaking, that is into this place that feels exposing. And yet that's in a way what truth feels like. And on the other side of that is freedom. But I don't know if it ever gets easy.
And as a matter of fact, you point out that sometimes there's a lot to be gained by God's guiding us into moments of helplessness.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, I think, you know, getting back to that story with Patty even, you know, I think that there's a perception there that for me to be who she needs me to be, that means there is no insecurity, there is no weakness in me, I just can always remain strong. But as it turns out, the intimacy so often comes in that place of vulnerability, which has that sort of disrobing effect. And I think it's similar in our relationship with God, that the deeper things that my heart is longing for is to be loved as I am, who I am, and so often I can't even tolerate that image of myself. And so I'm constantly going every way else but to that place of intimacy, where God is leading us into that place. The exposing and all of that, in many ways, that's the ego's resistance. You know, I've heard that we cannot transform without our ego being disappointed. And so often I think the suffering there is something that necessarily needs to diminish, but it doesn't go quietly.
You are really open about yourself in the book, here I am, and you tell us that you are a bit terrified when you do weddings, but you also believe it is a wonderful opportunity. How do the two of them work together?
Well, it's so deeply meaningful. You know, I think when I come away from a wedding or something of that nature, I am so honored to be able to step right into the midst of such a sacred moment. And so I love it. I delight in it. And yet something in myself that I think always sort of fears that is there going to be enough of me? That at least that's kind of where my mind goes as I think about that. There's this kind of pressure to show up. And I think knowing myself, there's plenty of times where I realize I don't have the emotional energy that I think I need or that's expected of me. And so what you end up having to do is go into a situation like that, really, in a way, in over your head, that you're stepping into it in obedience. But if God doesn't sort of show up in the midst of it, there's not really an adequate plan B. And that can feel terrifying on the front end. And yet, I don't know if I can think of a time where God wasn't faithful to provide the grace and what was necessary in that situation. So part of that is just learning to walk in faith and trust, but you're doing so in such a way that, it feels risky. Mm-hmm. And so to step into those situations of our weakness that you feel like, oh no, I'm like kind of walking off a cliff here. I sure hope that I'm caught.
Right. And so you're right. We must learn how to stand alone. We must sink deep roots that allow us to endure the rushing floods of criticism. We must learn to bend and not break. It is the lonely role of the peacemaker, but it is a role that the world so desperately needs. It is a role that the church so desperately needs. To stop drawing circles or playing the game of who is in and who is out, to stand in conviction, drink deeply, and remain. And that's how you close that particular chapter before you begin to talk about living with questions. Tell us about how you believe you are wired to ask the questions that no one else wants to ask.
Well, and, you know, for me, that just feels normal. But
of course.
You know, I remember this first occurring to me like in a I remember taking an advocacy and argument class, and in this kind of back and forth in this discussion and debate, somebody from, you know, from the audience that was kind of giving their comments and reflections said, I kind of feel like Jeff was the only one listening. And I remember thinking about that, going, well, why wouldn't we all be listening? Why is there such resistance to that? And I don't know how unique that is about me, except that I find myself really curious, wanting to hear and understand the other side. And so I'm not patting myself on the back for that, but I certainly look around and continue to see a lack of real listening and think we have not done a good job of really developing that skill of paying attention, listening even deeper than the words to kind of the heart that's behind it. And so questions for me have never felt threatening. And new ideas have always, I think, had a sort of natural appeal. I find myself so curious. But I've, you know, I even kind of grew up in an environment where that made people worry. It created a sense of a lack of ease. You know, when you're asking that question, you realize, oh, there's certain questions that we've all decided not to ask. And yet I found myself gravitating right there and saying, wait, what about this?
And new ideas can be dangerous, can't they?
Yeah, they can feel disruptive. And yet I think disruption's part of how we grow, that the questions become so important, and yet oftentimes I think we would prefer to just sort of be left alone. But that's a false sort of comfort and control, and yet seems like it's often sort of the preferred go-to. I think of that even as a pastor, that that oftentimes people are longing to just hear what they already believe repeated back, that there's a soothing that comes with that. But I'm not wired that way. I find myself digging a little deeper every time.
And yet you admit that there is a slow opening, that God is growing and enlarging my heart and healing at the same time. This is the way of transformation. And the texture of transformation is freedom. How can one know when their heart is growing and enlarging and being healed at the same time by God?
It's a good question. And I think from my own experience, if we're not careful, we can miss it, the growth that's taking place. I remember a time where I was sitting with my spiritual director, and she asked me a question pertaining specifically to my role as leader in my church. And she said, "Jeff, do you have any problem seeing yourself in that role?" And I said, "Oh, no, I'm comfortable with it." And she paused because she realized that I was kind of wanting to go on to the next thing. And she said, "Jeff, I think we need to pay attention to the fact that that's all we've talked about for the last couple of years."
Yes.
And she had realized I had grown. And oftentimes when growth takes place, we don't see it. We have like no adequate way of measuring it except for the fact that what was causing anxiety or security before that all of a sudden now just seems small. And I think that's one of the ways that I would describe sort of the texture of freedom, is almost a lovely sort of indifference or detachment, where that thing that used to worry us, all of a sudden we look at and realize isn't a threat or doesn't feel unsafe, that it's an indication that we've grown. And I think that, too, there's an example I use in the book that's a story from the book Prince Caspian that C.S. Lewis writes. It's one of the Narnia stories where the little girl Lucy ends up seeing the lion again as she's come back into this magical land and realizes that the lion is bigger. And her realization is, oh, that the lion has grown. But Aslan, the lion, says to her, "No, it's actually you that grown." And I think that sometimes that too, that our growth and the freedom that comes with it, all of a sudden we realize that God is bigger. And it's not that we've diminished in size, but in actuality that our hearts have grown as well.
Yeah, you've been convinced ever since junior high school that there is something deeply flawed about you. And you write, "I've been convinced that I am missing some key piece that everyone else possesses. It wasn't just some paranoid delusion. I could tell that I lacked the confidence, the quick wit, the aggressive gene that others around me seemed to possess and carry with such ease." And I could go on and on about what you write, but you believe that God's power is perfected in our weakness. So tell us a bit about how you have learned to compensate for that weakness when insecurity has been a kind of a lifelong companion.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I don't know if you pay attention to Enneagram stuff or any of that. I think that this is sort of the Enneagram 4 dilemma, is this sense that, you know, there's this flaw from within. And I think some of that was just a realization of things about me that felt unique growing up. I think that uniqueness feels unique when, in fact, most likely all of us carry some of that feeling that there's certain things that we don't possess or that we wish we did. There's strengths that we have, and yet with that, weaknesses we can't avoid. And I think part of the freedom is coming to terms with our own uniqueness and learning to embrace that, this idea of who I am, not just as a measure of where I'm strong, but also those areas of myself where I find myself dependent on others, that those are powerful parts of who I am, as far as how we all work together and are all interconnected, and the dependence, it's not there as some sort of design flaw, but it's there actually by design in God's artistic brilliance. So I think some of it is learning to embrace that. Some of it is learning to realize that all of us, to some extent, feel these same thoughts. And for me, I think part of it is that I like to feel unique. I like to feel special, too. So as much as I might torture myself with that, the thought of being like everybody else, I don't like that idea either. You know, so
yes.
I think there can be dysfunctional ways of holding on to our uniqueness. But part of the freedom is when that ego and that need dissipates, it just allows us to be ourselves vulnerably, creatively, and to really give back and contribute to this world. So rather than me hiding or diminishing, it gives me the courage to kind of step more fully into what I'm called to do.
Well, you're right. It's a sobering realization that new growth only comes at great cost. It is out of seasons of suffering that new life begins. Only when we have weathered storms do we see more clearly. And the pattern of transformation, you write, is death and resurrection, and it is the need for new birth. And let me just take us out to our final, we have more than a minute than that. What is the significance of small prayers?
Oh, well, I love that chapter. It's a simple little chapter, but it's one that I see again and again where God will answer something so specifically, and there's almost a delicacy to these little prayers that you're almost embarrassed to share, because when you look at the world around, these small things can seem so trivial and yet so specific and intimate. And I think that those small prayers, I'm realizing, are there to give us context. I think when we look at the world and so many things feel out of our control, or we're wondering, God, where are you in these greater needs, or the deep despair and the wounding in the world, that sometimes these little prayers are like a reassurance where God comes in and says, I know you, I see you, and I'm there too. In the midst of all the complexity, I'm there. And so the small prayer becomes a reassurance that doesn't just come in and in some sweeping move take care of all that is wrong in the world, but it comes in as something that sustains us, this little glimpse of joy or this picture of God's love where he comes alongside and just says, keep going.
You're right. Faith is an awkward road to walk. It is understood looking backwards, but live forward, as Kierkegaard said. That means that each step is a risk. There are no guarantees, no formulas to count on. We cling to the moments of meaning and cohesiveness we've experienced and plunge into the unknown. And later you write, could it be that the more powerful sermon is not the one that insists on being right, but instead the one that puts its finger on the actual wound and asks why, that admits that things don't always make sense, that acknowledges that faith is messier than we would like it to be. We'll take this break. Welcome back to the final segment of Amplify, just about 20 minutes. We end a couple minutes before the top of the hour. Our guest is Jeffrey Tackland. He is a professor. He has a doctorate. He doesn't want to hear all these things, I can assure you. But most of all, he's a spiritual director, too. And you see that in the book. Is titled The Winding Path of Transformation. It's a certainly a book worth reading, The Winding Path of Transformation. He writes, in the spiritual growth is necessarily slow work. It requires us to till the soil of our hearts, to wait patiently for the roots to grow deep, and to wait patiently until the fruit has ripened to its fullest and most flavorful. In other words, it takes time. It takes a lifetime. And without vision and hope, the waiting can be unbearable. And we keep talking about the middle place. He writes, the middle place is not a destination to arrive, or a place to visit and leave. Instead, it is a way of being, a way of loving, a way of engaging. Ultimately, it is the way of Jesus. Can transformation be measured at all, Jeff?
You know, I think it's a difficult one to quantify, but I think that, you know, Scripture is going to use kind of our senses, like tasting and seeing this quality of the fruit, that there is an aroma to transformation, that kind of thing that comes, a life well lived, that... And so in that way, yeah, I think that we can experience what growth is like and pay attention to that, the texture of it, the flavor of it. But at the same time, I don't think it works in a comparative sense with others. I think that it's almost always just simply a matter of our own journey that we're able to sort of keep track along the way. But yeah, it can be difficult to navigate too. I think that there is oftentimes a discouragement that comes when we find ourselves going back around again. And I kind of point to this in the book that we see seasons where we are progressing through and we are moving forward. But just because we're in the summertime, it doesn't mean that the fall isn't just around the corner. And so I noticed that in my life, where there's kind of a circularity to this, and yet maybe it's a little bit like a train going around a mountain and around a mountain. It's back at that starting place, but it's gone a little bit further up.
In writing a chapter titled Living and Joy and Grief, you point out that life seems to hold out both goodness and grief all at once, that joy and grief speak into each other. And grief reminds us just how costly it is to love. Tell us a little bit about why that's so important.
Yeah, well, I think that I've just found that to be true. It's more of an observation that oftentimes in my life, you know, whether as a pastor or as a husband or a father, as I'm going through and I experience a sense of suffering or deep loss, feelings of loneliness or whatever that is, that oftentimes in the midst of that, there are these moments of joy that penetrate in. And I think about that, you know, just right now in the midst, there's some real loss that's taken place in my life with the passing of a few people, and one very confusing, and you know, and so I'm suffering with my church as I'm leading it through, and yet in the midst of that have been some brilliant moments of just God's love breaking in. And I think that idea of these things speaking to each other, the necessity of moving through the suffering in a way that's not looking the other way or distracting myself from all the intensity that it brings, and yet these reminders of who God is, this deep affection and love, that the brokenness that we experience is a necessary part of this journey, and yet isn't ultimately what we're designed for. So that sort of conversation, I think at first I would almost feel guilty to be in the midst of a really hard moment and to be experiencing joy, and yet now I think I understand that's the way that God comes in and gives us strength. That the joy of the Lord is our strength, and it's like in the midst of the suffering, God is careful to come in and provide the grace and the joy needed to be able to endure.
Tell us about the concept of reframing and how it is important within this particular context.
Well, yeah, that's so good. I think that idea, you know, reframing is kind of a buzzword, and yet it's such an important word, this way of being able to see this thing, this situation from a little different vantage point, and to realize so often when we're stuck, it's because our vision has become so myopic, and that all it takes is even looking at the exact same circumstance from a different angle, and we realize, oh, no, this is just right. I think that so often we see our life through, again, a very narrow window. We see it for myself, I think, in terms of comfort or in terms of my own sort of small goals or small story, when God is constantly beckoning me to see from that place, again, from more of a God's eye view. I think that God is constantly reshaping and helping us reframe our circumstances to realize it's just what we need. And sometimes those moments of disappointment end up turning out to be just God's perfect timing. And that thing that we were so intent upon achieving was the last thing we needed. And so, again, I think that this takes... Often it takes a companion. It takes somebody that's alongside of us that can help us to do that. I think this is one of the things I value so much about my spiritual director, is she's constantly helping me to reframe my circumstance when I fall into despair, to help me see it from just a little bit different angle and maybe understand the deeper work God is doing.
In the chapter titled The Tension of Glory and Humility, you begin with a story of surfing. But then you reflect on the heart of God. What can you tell us about God's heart?
That God is constantly wanting us to see more and more. That God is a God of deep beauty, and that God is a God of redemption. That the story that God tells is so often one of broken beauty that's been restored. And I think it's discovering that God doesn't lead us, you know, through life in the hopes that we'll get out of it unscathed, but instead that sometimes those places of brokenness are, you know, it's where, gosh, the depth comes into play. I love there's a Japanese pottery where they will take a broken vessel and mend it with gold. And I think it's such a picture of the story that God is often telling in our lives. This is what God wants us to see, that our stories of safety and comfort, that our little small goals that reflect our own ego, they bore even ourselves, that we know we're made for something greater than that. And I think God is constantly trying to beckon us to a greater story. But that is going to be a one that takes courage. It's going to be a one that along the way is going to be humbling to our ego. And yet in it, this is where the glory comes in. This is where God starts telling a story big enough to capture our hearts.
Reading from The Winding Path of Transformation, Jeremiah 29:13 says, quote, "You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart," close quote. And then Jeff writes, "All our heart requires courage. That is what courage actually means, to expose your heart, to make it vulnerable. This is where our eyes are open to the greater spiritual realities surrounding us. When we see from this place of humility, courage and vulnerability, we are seen with a heart, or what Scripture refers to the eyes of the heart." And I would think when you look at Patty, you would see God's heart also.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, I think the gift of Patty is, you know, she sees my true self like no one else does. And she said to me the other day, "Jeff, you see yourself like this, but I see you like this."
Right.
So she's stretching her arms, you know, and I thought, oh gosh, we need that. So much we need that. But how much more is God seeing us like that? And that to me is, that's the love that I long for. But it's just so there and present, coming from my wife. And it just means the world to me.
The love of God, you write, reminds us of the greater reality that God is near and that we have enough. The reality of this steadfast love destroys my scarcity mentality. It disarms my avarice. It allows me to love sacrificially. Poetic spiritual words. I mean, it's a wonderful book that way. It's has deep spiritual aspect to it, and yet is written in a poetic way. And so it touches the heart, and I think it can help us to find to know more about our own heart, and to also find to discover more about the heart of God. And while we're talking about discovering, the final chapter is discovering joy. And you have a Nouwen quote in there too, but you write in this particular place, "The mystery of God's grace," and this is taken from Henry Nouwen, "the mystery of God's grace is that he often changes us in ways that we were not planning on, and that sometimes we do not have eyes to see or ears to hear these changes in ourselves. I deeply believe that God is always active in us and always molding us into new people." And I can affirm that. One more year, I'll be 80 years old. And so I can tell you about all the things in my own life, about how the mystery of God's grace has brought about changes I never expected, I didn't plan on, I didn't think I could do. And therefore, I didn't want to do them because I didn't want to make myself look bad.
Sure. Yeah.
And so you write, "Weaknesses are not accidental and are intimately a part of my story. They represent my signature sins. This is the place where I do battle, and victory is not their illumination, but instead a steady and often subtle growth toward deeper character, toward what Paul calls maturity in Christ. This battle is, and always will be, where my real work is done, and it happens in the depths of my soul, because that is what God is, after all along, my heart, which is why God is continually leading me back into the wilderness. This is the place where my heart is tested. It is where I see my darkness exposed and my utter dependency revealed." Say a little bit about God is continually leading you back into the wilderness.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, it's this idea, you know, that I think in this lifetime we're just never finished. There's always more. And just when we think we've got this chapter figured out, we're on to the next chapter. It's part of, you know, the way that life is constantly leading us through seasons and, you know, is broken up into, you know, I love how people like Richard Rohr have kind of outlined a first and second half of life. But the fact that just when we think we've got something figured out, life seems to change and to shift. And that, too, is there by design. I think it keeps us moving. And so, you know, there's a quote that I put in there from C.S. Lewis where he's saying that along this journey, life may give us some comfortable inns to stay in, and yet we're never to mistake those as our home, that God is constantly beckoning us towards what's new and greater and more. And yet, you know, there is this thing in us that is thinking this is far enough, that we've arrived, that this is good enough, and yet God is pulling us deeper and deeper in, which means going back into those times of wilderness, going back into those times that feel desolate, and yet finding and rediscovering and finding new things about who God is in that wilderness place, I think is a part of the journey and will be for the rest of our lives. At least the invitation is there.
You're right. When I draw up blueprints for my life, they are always in some way geared towards the praise and applause of others. I want to build a life that is impressive, to be seen as brilliant, to have my gifts and talents prominently on display. This world in which I am the center is the world God is inviting me out of. God's version, instead, focuses on my heart. And although this place is precious to me, I find that I have so little real understanding of it. To find this place requires obedience and surrender. God knows me so much better than I know myself. Would that we all realize that.
Yeah.
And then you write, for me to be a saint means to be myself, therefore the problem, oh no, excuse me, this is first of all Merton's quote, for me to be a saint means to be myself, therefore the problem of sanctity and salvation is in fact the problem of finding out who I am and of discovering my true self. Close quote. And you write, that is the person that God is always molding, and he's doing more than growing my true self. He's also shaping my desires along with it, helping me to see how bankrupt my small visions of self-centered glory are compared to the freedom of simply being who he has made me to be. There's the struggle, isn't it? Understanding the person God has made me to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And yet it's exciting, too,
yes.
That discovery, right? That as you see it more and more, I think that there is such a healthy sort of self-love that comes when we're not trying to defend these false sides or these ego sides, that that we're able to, I think, really, when we see who we are and see God's love and delight in us, we're able to love ourselves in a way that's respectful of who God's made us to be.
And a quote-unquote prophet from a nearby church eventually comes to you, and this is what he said. Joyous Jeff, you're stronger than what you know. There's someone you've underestimated, and it's Jeff. And it's time for you to know that you are a king and that you rule with a lot of authority. You'll do it in a gentle way. There are ones that really need to hear and how you help unlock them in the days to come. You have a symphony of hope. Reformers are walking with you. I guess this evening has been Jeffrey Tackland. We've been talking about his book, The Winding Path of Transformation, subtitled Finding Yourself Between Glory and Humility. Jeff, I think many of us, myself and those listening, have found ourselves in your stories. And we have hopefully learned some of the lessons you have learned. And so it will help to bring us closer to God and to be the person he's created us to be. Thank you so very much for being with us, spending this time.
It's been wonderful,
and
I've so enjoyed this.
Thank you, and my blessings to your family, especially to Patty. Maybe
I will tell her for sure.
Okay. Hopefully we can do this again sometime. Thanks very much.
I would love it.
All right.
You're welcome.
Bye
now.
Thank
you so much. Bye-bye.
So we've come now to the end of our program. There was so much more that could have been said and done. Let me just read a little bit to bring us up to the end of the program, again from The Winding Path of Transformation. The work of heart transformation is like peeling away layers of an onion, and this can be a painful process, and the work is never-ending. The wounds run so deep. And so the work will always continue. I say this to remind myself that I will never be finished, not in this lifetime. The one constant thing in this life is change. The warmth of summer fades, the long days will begin to shorten, the temperatures will start to cool, and we'll find ourselves gearing up for the fall once again, for the next stage of the journey. And we'll remind ourselves that all of this is worth it, that the deep heart work of transformation is what gives life its meaning and beauty, and that our roots continue to deepen. There is a seasonal dance, and we are all swept up in it. We are all participants, willingly or unwillingly, but we can choose how we respond. We can resist the movement or we can yield to it, to be present in it and to trust the leadings of God, the nudges and the twirls. And above all, we are invited to savor it all for all of its beauty and the depth and meaning it provides. This is where hope resides. This is hope we grow. We lose sight of tangible measurements, and we start to lose sight of where we're going and how far we've come. Let me just say in closing that don't forget how precious life is and how powerful love is. Tell someone now that you love him or her. Pray for peace as if it depended on you alone. And come back next Sunday and amplify with us.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.